For the week of July 8th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 415, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Welcome back, Sperling.
Well, thank you very much. I feel like, I don't know, how hot is it in Birmingham right now? Because I feel like somehow it's probably hotter where I am.
Well, there are wildfires and record heat waves all over the world right now, so it's pretty darn hot.
Yeah, I mean, I think where I am, it was 115 degrees on Saturday.
Where you were on vacation with your family.
Yes, was on vacation, but got back to Los Angeles and it was 115 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot to ask you a question. Before the show begins, I usually ask you a question and I didn't do it. Is there a show next week? Because last week we were off. So I'm just making sure. Are we set for next week?
We are set for next week. And thank you for asking.
Yeah, sweet. Good to know. So it was a busy 2 weeks while you were gone. The AT&T, they bought Time Warner. And then they immediately raised the price of their basic unlimited plan by $5. And they dropped free HBO as an incentive.
Wait a second. So AT&T, the company that their unlimited plan is their wireless service, correct?
Right.
Okay, so but I thought it was, well, I guess it is all the same company, right? AT&T Cable and AT&T UVerse and AT&T Wireless, they're all the same AT&T ultimately.
Right, but Judge Richard Leon spent a lot of time worrying about whether this plan or that plan would go up by a nickel or not. We could have told him, yes, it will, and in fact, they didn't waste much time. But I do have some house cleaning to do. Oh, I hope his bill goes up, by the way. We do have some house cleaning to do. The World Cup has been very exciting. My stomach was in knots watching Croatia beat Russia. So glad they won. Go Croatia. And of course, I'm rooting for England because I was born in Bermuda. So I am a British subject. But 2 weeks ago, you may not remember, I said World Cup ratings were up in North America. Well, they weren't. They were a shell of what they were in 2014. I speedily read a story that wasn't as clear and accurate as I would have liked, and I misread and misunderstood it, and I reported it wrong. I'm sorry for that. U.S. ratings are down from 2014, but the games featuring Mexico while they were still in were good. So they were doing best. So hilariously, Fox Sports was rooting for Mexico. I like that. But internationally, ratings are good, not great. It is going to be an all-European semifinal, so that's not great because you want to, you know, Japan was the only Asian country to make it past the first round. The U.S. wasn't in it. None of that helps. But, you know, ratings can be great all over the world. It's like the World Series. You want, you know, the Yankees and the Dodgers. You want the geographic spread or big market teams, you know, that sort of thing. You want a good story, but it's fun. It's exciting. I really do feel like World Cup has turned a corner in North America. People are watching, even though the U.S. hasn't been in it. So I think while the numbers aren't as good when U.S. is there, I think they're much better than they were for previous World Cups where the U.S. was not a factor. And one country, this is cool, Iceland. Iceland did the best. Their first round match against Argentina drew 60%, not of the TV viewing audience, 60% of the entire country watched that match. 99.6% of the people who were watching TV at that time were watching Iceland's World Cup, which leads one to ask, all right, in Iceland, our viewers, who was watching reruns of that hit drama Trapped instead of the game? Come on, people. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well, wait a second. This is one of those statistics that kind of falls into the category of there's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics. Do you know how many people live in Iceland?
337,000 people, roughly, and virtually everybody there was watching the game.
Of course, there's only 337,000 people. Of course, they're all watching it. Half of them are playing the game.
That's a World Cup, though. It's exciting. It's good. And one other little bit of news, California has extended their film tax credits to 2025. They found a lot of success with that. I've seen lists and stories saying, these are the 12 or 15 shows that have come back to shoot in California since they put these tax credits in place. So they really feel like they have a good story to tell and they're going to keep doing it. But I want to say, hey, where's the money for the podcasts?
Yeah, where are those? I agree. They need to have a podcast tax credit.
Absolutely. And until they do, though, we want your support. Rate and review the show. And you can do that while Sperling tells us what's going to be on this show this week.
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got some great stories to cover. I mean, I ask, whether I've really only been gone for a week, because Hollywood seems to be saving all of their big news for when I'm out of town. I mean, come on, guys. Anyway, the North American Theater Owners Association, NATO, they named a new head, and Michael will be asking me what, if anything, that means, and I think it means I better, I don't know, probably come up with something clever to say before the end of this introduction. In the Middle Kingdom, China, the Chinese government is in fact cracking down on those yin-yang contracts we discussed a few weeks ago. Apparently, even in a one-party government, they want you to pay your taxes. And then there's MoviePass, which changed the rules again. And Disney's acquisition of those Fox assets got the green light, minus the string of regional sports networks they were probably eager to absorb. Hey, Fox, mind if Disney shaves off $1 billion or so from that last bid they gave you? Yeah, I thought so. In Book Filter, Michael will recommend a fantasy novel that's just too good to ignore, and Hollywood, take note, it has not one, not two, but three strong female leads. Oh, and it's got some roles for the guys too, apparently. During sexual misconduct news, we've got some possible news involving Barnes and Noble and some definite news involving those poster boys for potentially criminal behavior or alleged criminal behavior, Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey. On Inside Baseball, we look at the music industry. The Grammys expanded its top categories from 5 nominees to 8. Spotify is going all in on the concert business, and Drake's new album set all sorts of streaming records, but don't go looking for it at Best Buy. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And before I do, if Sperling makes a joke and it doesn't land and you hear crickets, no, those are actual crickets outside my window in Birmingham. The crickets are so loud, it's unbelievable. Sperling could hear them. I don't know if you will once all the audio is done, but wow, they're loud. They are really, really loud. The crickets are listening to the show.
This is what happens when you're on the road. You know, when you're on assignment there, it's tough.
I just realized why the crickets care. They care because the number one movie in the world is Ant-Man and the Wasp. Of course, the crickets are listening to Showbiz Sandbox. They're going, yay, Wasp. Yay, Ant-Man. Fellow insects.
Or whatever. Did you forget what species they were?
Well, I'm not sure. They're an insect, right? They must be. Well, we are looking at box office around the world. We've got a link to ComScore in our show notes and all the other places we check out. And yes, indeed, the number one movie in the world is Ant-Man and the Wasp. We're looking at you, Paul Rudd. $161 million on its opening weekend, which of course includes Thursday. It's the 20th film in a row from Marvel to debut at number one in the North American box office, and I don't think that's true worldwide, but the 20th film in a row to be at number one at the North American box office, that's a crazy run.
That really is. I mean, to open every movie and for it to be number one. Now, you could say, well, I just picked good weeks. I picked January. I picked February. No, I mean, these movies, they are opening.
They're opening, and they're very profitable. Maybe the first Incredible Hulk, maybe one or two others were, you know, iffy, but basically you're looking at 17 or 18 films easily that made a lot of money. I mean, they have all been successful. It's not the run of Pixar that they had because they're not critically crazed, you know, the way those Pixar movies were for 10 or 15 years, but they are certainly making a lot of money. But they're not the only film making money. At number two around the world is Dying to Survive. This is a Chinese black comedy, a dramedy, if you like, and it's about a leukemia patient who smuggles in drugs for himself and other patients. It's sort of the China equivalent to the Dallas Buyers Club. And just like that movie starring Matthew McConaughey, it's based on a true story, and it is a huge, huge phenomenon in China. They had 4 days of previews, which I would call... No, you've already opened, but no, they called them previews, and then it opened up over the weekend, and so far, on the weekend, it made $146 million, so a total, it's got $191 million. We don't know the budget, but this is not a big, fat, expensive movie. This is a dark comedy, not wildly typical for the Chinese market. It stars, who is the actor? It stars Xu Chuang, the comic actor who was in the Lost in Thailand series. We mentioned them when they were an ongoing series of hit films. So it's a comedy star going dramatic. It's a black comedy, which isn't typical for that country. It's gotten rave reviews, and they're hoping it's going to be their Oscar contender. And I'm sure it will be. I'm sure China will nominate it, and it might just well, you know, become a player. So Dying to Survive is a hot property in China. I mean, $191 million, to the point where you're seeing stories about how Dying to Survive is going to change China. You know, get people riled up about healthcare and the inequities and things like that. But this is a big, big hit film.
You know, it's not showing in the U.S.
No, I know. I was thinking, all right, this one I have to make sure I go see because it has such good reviews across the board. But you're right. It hasn't opened up here yet. It certainly will. Perhaps they're waiting to time it to an Oscar campaign because they know they've got a really hot property and the reviews are so good. They have to think this is a great shot making that play.
I would wonder whether there's any issues with piracy for this film.
Well, I'm sure people are snapping it up and looking at it because that's always an issue with films in that market. So the Chinese audience in America that wants to see it doesn't want to wait. That's why they have day and date releases more and more all around the world. So maybe it's the type of film they feel like people will support anyway, or it'll just work better long term. I'm sure mostly it's just an example of like they've got lightning in a bottle and they didn't know what they had. And so I don't think they had any grand dramatic plan. They're just suddenly going, oh my God, now what? And so now they're thinking maybe we should wait longer. I don't know. It's not the type of film necessarily you would have expected to be huge. So you wouldn't necessarily plan day and date on, like, say, another Journey to the West film. You know, it's not a big franchise. It's a small, dark comedy, but it's exploded and it's just begun. And number three around the world is another big film. It's Incredibles 2, $64 million on the weekend, $770 million worldwide, not so much in China. The Incredibles 2 has made about $50 million and it's slowing down pretty quickly. It's never been number one and it's falling off the charts. I mean, it's like number eight this week or five or something in China, but it's not tearing it up there. So for whatever reason, that movie's not clicking. But I'm pretty sure with all the rest of the world, we're looking at, China hurts, but I think you're still going to get to $1 billion because this movie is doing tremendously well in North America. It's over the $500 million mark already. It's the highest grossing animated film of all time in North America. Of course, that's without adjusting for inflation. But in a few weeks, with another $30 million, this sucker is going to be in the top 10 all time of North American films. It's a lot of money.
Can I just say that I'm looking at the Ent Group's box office chart here, and they track Chinese box office. Mm-hmm. And it looks like from 7/2 to 7/8, the week of that week, so July 2nd to July 8th, 356 million people saw Dying to Survive.
So the average ticket price is like 80 cents?
The average ticket price, believe it or not, admissions per showing, 48. Per ticket average, $35.
No.
That's.
No. You're not looking at the numbers.
But maybe
right.
It's 35 million people.
Yeah.
Yeah. 35,681. Yeah. Sorry. This is what happens when you get older. Your eyes start going, and you can't read small fine print. And sure enough, it's 35 million people. My bad.
Well, Grandpa, that's a lot of people still to see a movie on opening weekend. In North America, if 35 million people went to a film at about $8 average ticket price, you're looking at $250 million. So that's a lot of people. And again, the numbers for The Incredibles, $770 million and counting. It will, I think, join the $1 billion club. That's where Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom is, not to mention Black Panther and Avengers Infinity War. That movie, Jurassic World, made another $56 million over the weekend. It had passed the $1 billion mark while we were away. And number five is another opener, another big new movie on the chart, The First Purge. This is a prequel to the Purge movies, explaining how the Purges began. $28 million on the weekend, $42 million worldwide, because it opened up a few days early here and there. It's picking it up. It's making a lot of money. Every Purge film has grossed more than the one before. That's true in North America, and that's true overseas. So if that holds, this movie is going to hit about $120 million and counting worldwide. At number six is Sanju. This is an Indian biopic about the famed actor and producer. It grossed $13 million this weekend. It's at just under $60 million and counting worldwide. Last weekend, while we were away, we had two films in the top 10, Mr. Rogers, the documentary, and an Indian film, Sanju. That's pretty amazing. It doesn't happen a lot. This week, we've got four films in the top 20 who are non-traditional movies. We've got the Mr. Rogers, the documentary, which is now the highest grossing documentary of the year so far. And we've also got the Whitney Houston documentary, which just missed the top 10. I was so bummed. A couple $100,000 more would have been in the top 10. And at number 17 in North America, we have the Sundance flick, Three Identical Strangers. Three documentaries in the top 20 and Sanju. That's crazy. That is a sea change in the movies that people are going to go see in North America. But getting back to the box office, at number 7 is Ocean's 8, still making a lot of money, $236 million worldwide. Sicario, Day of the Soldado, also pulling in bucks, $50 million worldwide. And number 9, we have a new film in China. It's a low-budget animated flick called New Happy Dad and Son, Part 3, Adventure in Russia. And that made about $10 million over the weekend, though, hey, Happy Dad, why did you take your son to Russia? Maybe they went to the World Cup, I don't know.
Well, they would have been sorely disappointed then on Sunday. What day was it? I guess it was Saturday.
Now, here's a fun fact. Michael Douglas has two films in the top 10 worldwide. One of them, of course, is Ant-Man and Wasp, where he plays a scientist and a hero, a good guy. And if you like the first Ant-Man, you'll like the second one. It's perfectly fine, just like the first one. And he's also in Animal World. This is a Chinese thriller that he plays the villain in. It grossed $8 million over the weekend. It's at $61 million worldwide, and it's got really good special effects. There's some elaborate stuff going on. And how did they do it? We've been talking about the special effects in China. Well, guess what? They hired the Hollywood guys that do it best. They're not actually Hollywood. They're just Hollywood mainstays. They hired Weta from New Zealand and Rising Sun of Australia. I guess proximity helps a little bit, right? They're closer to China than we are. But those are the two FX companies that were hired to do the special effects on the film, and it's getting good reviews for its effects.
Well, so, and China's, if you look at the end of any of these Marvel films or these big, you know,
you see 30 companies listed.
Yes, it's unreal how many people work on these. I didn't know that many people were on Earth, let alone that many people could actually work at effects houses.
But the problem there, we still have a big problem with effects houses, don't we? Where they're all asked to crash things last minute. Everybody works on it, and they all are just pressured all the time for margins and money. And then each one crashes, and the new one steps in, right?
Right. I always say working for the studios is like working, you know, it's like having cancer. It's going to kill you at some point, you know, because they just continuously lower and lower and lower what they are willing to pay you. And well, at some point, you're paying them to do the job.
Well, maybe you can use China as a leverage. If they're going to pay more money, you can say, hey, you're not the only game in town. They did a good job on Animal World. That's a thriller based on the manga about a young man taking part in a sort of dangerous game overseen by the Michael Douglas character. So that's cool. At number 11 is Uncle Drew. This is a notable film. It opened up last weekend, did pretty well. It grossed $7 million this weekend. It's at $30 million and counting. It's a not well-reviewed movie. It's spun off from a commercial about an old guy playing basketball. You got lots of sports stars appearing in this movie. Not great reviews, but not horrible, I guess. It's making a little bit of money. It maybe cost about $18 million to make. So it's got a little bit of ways to go, but they'll probably be okay no matter what. The question is this the first film spun off from a commercial?
Probably not, I would say.
I thought there must be something else, some character, like maybe Tony the Tiger made a movie or something. I looked and looked. I couldn't find an example. The best example I could find was the California Raisins. They never made a movie, but they did make a string of TV specials. They even won an Emmy for one of their TV specials, and they put out platinum albums. The Raisins put out Motown-style albums. So, they had big success. But as far as a commercial-turned movie, as far as I can tell, Uncle Drew is the first one. If you know different, if you know of a commercial that became a film, tell us.
Well, what about the Mean Joe Green one? And I know you
that
were
was adorable, but it wasn't the Coke. You mean have a Coke and then where the football player, shares a Coke with the kid? Well, that was an adorable commercial, but what movie was there?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question.
It's just a memorable ad. That's all. If they know the answer, though, they can contact us. How can they do that?
Oh, that's true. That's what you were trying to get me to say. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. And by the way, I just looked it up, even though this is only one of what could be many, adaptations, if you will, from commercial to movies. And in this case, it's a TV movie. So please do write to us, follow us, tweet us, let us know if we're missing any. So that Pittsburgh Steeler Mean Joe Green commercial, right, where he throws his jersey at the kid for the Coca-Cola.
Made that into a TV film?
They made that into a TV movie called The Steeler and the Pittsburgh Kid.
Oh, God, it must have been awful.
Now, yeah, Green, you know, Mean Joe Green played himself. And the boy, guess who the boy was played by?
What year did it come out?
1981?
I'm going to say Macaulay Culkin.
1982? God, no. Gosh, no. I don't even think was born yet. Henry Thomas. And if that name sounds familiar, Elliot.
Perfect star of E.T. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Elliot. He's a fine actor. Well, there you go. That's number 11 is Uncle Drew, the commercial turned hit film at number two, or modest hit film. And number 12 is Tag, the movie about adult men who still play tag. $6 million on the weekend, $60 million worldwide.
You know, I've been using my joke about how I loved that movie and I can't wait for the sequel, Marco Polo. People like that joke, I got to tell you.
People aren't joking about Solo, A Star Wars Story. Another $4 million on the weekend. That's at $380 million worldwide, and it's almost done. I mean, it doesn't have any territories left, does it?
I don't think, well, no, because it opened day and date almost everywhere. Why wouldn't you open that movie everywhere? I mean,
and it's already not done well in China, correct? They didn't care about Star Wars. So, there's nothing left for that movie. But for which, there is only the question of what movie is it? It's a film. It opened up at number 14. It grossed $4.1 million on the weekend. It has $13.7 million worldwide. It's being released by Warner Brothers, or distributed, I should say. But whose film it is and what's it about, I haven't a clue. Right below that is Deadpool 2. That's at about $730 million worldwide. And looking down for something new, Hotel Transylvania 3 is still playing in a one territory overseas. That's about to open up here. It's just gotten some poor reviews. Here's a new film. It's Sunset in My Hometown. It's a South Korean romantic drama about a handsome but failed young rapper who returns to his hometown and the very attractive girl he left behind. It looks funny, it looks sweet, it looks tearful. It opened up to $1.6 million over the weekend. In France, Tamara 2 opened, a sequel to a French-Belgian film about a plus-size teen girl. The first one obviously did well. Now there's a sequel. It opened to about $1.3 million. But what I want to look at is the North American box office. We already mentioned them. Mr. Rogers is in the top 10. He's now the highest grossing documentary film of the year in
Wait
North
a second.
America.
First of all, Mr. Rogers, unfortunately, is no longer with us, so he can't really benefit from the documentary about his life and his work.
But neither can Whitney Houston.
Good point.
Yeah, that film was directed by Kevin MacDonald, who's had some good success with feature films like The Last King of Scotland, but he's had a great run as an Oscar-winning filmmaker of documentary films. Whitney opened up at number 11, just a smidge behind Deadpool 2. That made $1.2 million on its opening weekend. Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Mr. Rogers film, was at number 9 in North America. That grossed $2.5 million. Its total is now $12.3 million. That's a lot of money for a documentary film. But there's even better news in the box office, and that's a film I think it's at number 17? It's an independent film. I don't know if you've seen it, Sperling. It's Sorry to Bother You, which is doing great in limited release. It was written and directed by the rapper Boots Riley. It premiered at Sundance, got picked up by Annapurna for what they say is probably around $4 million. People are vague, but they say it's a low, mid, seven-figure deal. So I'm guessing $4 million, something like that. And it's off to a terrific start. Great reviews, great interest at the limited box office release. That's a movie to keep an eye on.
And let me tell you, stories in the New York Times Magazine 3 weeks ago. There was a story in today's New York Times about the star of the film, who was also a star of Atlanta, the television show on FX. So it's getting a lot of ink.
China's supposed to have a blackout period come July, and yet there's two or three films that we know about that are coming out. One is Show Dogs, and another is Sherlock Gnomes. Show Dogs comes out in July. Sherlock Gnomes comes out on July 26th, to which I say, why would those be the movies they would let come to China? I mean, they're box office flops, basically. So what on what conceivable reason is there? Do they think there's some particular interest in China for them? I can't imagine. Are they just trying to say, let's put in some Hollywood movies so they don't yell at us, but we'll make sure they're not very good
family
so that
programming.
Our films do better?
It's family programming.
Ah, that's right. Well, they always want family programming. They're always short of them, I guess.
Well, in the middle of summer, yes.
I mean, when you get to choose from movies all over the world, why choose the bombs? And you're only going to let in 30 or 40. Why choose the ones that did poorly? When you have the luxury of waiting, you know, why would those be the ones that you would pick? One big movie that is going to come out there in July, July 20th, that's Dwayne Johnson's Skyscraper. And that comes from one of the backers of that movie is Legendary. They are behind both Jurassic World and Skyscraper, and they got an ideal Chinese release date for that movie. And Legendary just got themselves a brand spanking new $1 billion line of revolving credit because they want to make more movies, just like Skyscraper.
Right. Now, Skyscraper is the only movie being released in the United States and North America in July that is not based on a franchise.
But, you know, that's not true. There's plenty of movies.
Sorry. Big blockbuster, I should say. You're right. There are plenty of movies being released in July. What I meant was big studio film. And it's the only one that isn't, based on IP.
Well, you mean for the rest of the month or?
Just that one month.
I mean, you mean nothing earlier in this month was released that was sort of a big fat?
Well, what was released over July 4th? You had Ant-Man and Wasp, right?
You had what? Ant-Man and the Wasp, yeah.
And so that's a sequel. So what I'm saying is in July, you get mostly, this July, we're getting mostly sequels and remakes from the studios.
Right. 'Twas always thus. But maybe that's, is that a bad thing or a good thing as far as NATO is concerned?
Oh, I guess you want to talk about Ellis Jacobs.
That's right. He's the new head of NATO. And of course, the North American theater owners, they speak for 65,000 screens in 94 countries. That's the number of companies they represent and the screens that those companies control. There are 33,000 screens in the U.S. and Canada alone that they speak for. So that's a lot of countries, a lot of screens. And so Ellis Jacobs has a lot of power and a lot of responsibility. I'm not quite sure where NATO is or what they're worried about or what their concerns are or what their top priorities are. Is he going to focus that? Is that going to change? Is this represent some sort of upheaval at NATO? What's going on?
Well, a couple things. There's no upheaval. And NATO is a trade group, just like any other trade group in any other business, you know, whether it's sewing machines or pipe fitters, you know, it's, you know, certain industries need trade groups to go to Washington and speak to legislators and help iron things out. In this case, you have Ellis, and by the way, it's Ellis Jacob. He is now the NATO chairman. He is also the CEO of Cineplex, which is based in Toronto. It's Canada's largest theater chain. And then you have Rolando Rodriguez, who is the CEO of Marcus Theaters, based in Milwaukee, which is another kind of medium to large size chain in North America, and he will be vice chairman. And these are two positions that kind of come up every I want to say it's every 2 years. I can't remember how long the terms are for, but they tend to rotate between members, and they rotate between kind of members that are in good standing and are well liked and large enough that their voice holds sway.
So it's his turn.
Correct. Now remember,
whether he wants it or not.
Remember that, you know, Amy Miles was the CEO of Regal Entertainment and she held the position for a while. Well, obviously, you know, she's no longer the CEO of Regal Entertainment because that Regal Entertainment was purchased by Cineworld.
Well, that's the nature of the business, of course. But you're saying he's just taking his turn. It's business as usual from NATO.
Yeah. I mean, there's not, you know, certainly, you know, he will help steer it to some degree because he's on, you know, they do have a board of directors that does make certain decisions. But for the most part, it's not like there's going to be any huge shift in what the group does.
So it's not like SAG where you have people competing with different priorities and they say, we should be focused on this and someone else, we should be focused on popcorn. No, we should be focused on digital projectors. It's not like that.
Not as much. No.
Okay. Well, that's what's going on at NATO. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the Middle Kingdom about China and how there was this whole scandal over yin-yang contracts. This is sort of where you have one public contract showing, oh, I made $1 million on this movie. And then there's a secondary contract that maybe your production company or whatever, something else that you get to charge to, so that A, people don't realize how much money you're making, and B, you can sort of finagle your way and pay less taxes. Turned into a scandal, started by a TV presenter, focused on a female star, became a whole called celebra. And apparently, there's some fire where that smoke was, because the Chinese government is cracking down, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it feels like the Chinese government, kind of like our government sometimes, where they go, well, what do you mean you're tracking all of my Facebook searches? Facebook, I had no idea that you did that. You know, these interwebs are kind of a funny place. So in this case, it almost seems like the Chinese government had no idea that in the entertainment industry, in their entertainment industry, what was happening was there were, like you said, these two contracts. One would be the contract that you showed the government that said, oh, look at this, I only made a dollar. and that's what you paid taxes on. But the real contract was...
Funnily enough, I have that contract.
Yeah.
Berlin sends me a dollar once a year.
It's $2 now. In any case, you know, the contracts that are made with the loan out company, so to speak, a talent usually has a loan out company. That happens here in the U.S. and in Europe as well for tax purposes, where you're not paying the talent themselves. You're paying their loan out corporation, because paying a corporation means that the person can pay less taxes.
But it wasn't just about taxes. It really was about the social scandal over people getting too much money. You said a couple of weeks ago, oh, people love it when their favorite star makes a lot of money. In China, people are like, oh, that's wrong. You shouldn't be doing that. That's too much money. And in fact, the government has cracked down on what people are actually getting. They said, you know what? Number one, the pay for a star cannot exceed 40% of the total cost of the production. So if your movie costs $10 million, you can't pay them more than $4 million. They said pay to the leading cast members must be capped at 70% of total payments to the cast. They said this, that, and the other thing. They're cracking down on movie stars making too much money. They're even worried about celebrities taking part on TV reality shows, because it's turned out that celebrity shows like Where Are We Going, Dad?, where a celebrity takes their kids somewhere new, they were getting too much money to appear on those shows. So they're just cracking down left and right. And they just say, it's bad for morals when movie stars make too much money. We cannot have that in China. So I think George Clooney, Tom Cruise, even Tom Selleck, they're all glad they don't live in China.
Well, what will wind up happening is, you know, some of these, you know, there will be China-only films, right, where that are 100% China-owned and operated, so to speak, where they are made in China with Chinese talent and Chinese filmmakers and Chinese cast and crew and released in China. And they may never actually be released anywhere else. And if they are, but they're still China, you know, 100% Chinese. And then there will be films that are made with legendary or with, you know, either American backers or European backers, or that are kind of a hybrid. And that's how they'll get around that kind of law.
Okay. There's always loopholes, but
right, exactly.
They're saying movie stars shouldn't make too much money.
Yeah. That's pretty much what they're saying.
Right. And, you know, there's a lot of movies that they're making that don't need to play the rest of the world. They can just play Asia and they can make a lot of money. Look at the top of our show.
I was just going to say 35 million people. 35 million people, not 356, which would have been amazing, but still 35 million people is just as amazing.
I wonder if there are any MoviePass members among those 35 million people, because if they are, they just had new rules crop up about what movie they can see and when.
And if there are MoviePass members among those 35 million people seeing that film in China, the Dying to Survive, well, they're probably committing fraud, because MoviePass doesn't exist in China.
That's right. But a couple of weeks ago, they said, all right, we're going to have a bunch of new rules because we're running out of money. No, they said, it's going to be fun. We're going to have new rules because you'll love the new rules. One of them was peak pricing. And apparently it's gone into effect in some areas. It hasn't affected me here in Birmingham, Alabama. None of my friends in New York or LA have seen it yet. I don't know if you have. There's going to be a little thing that pops up and says, uh-oh, this is a peak demand movie at a peak demand time. You wanted to see Ant-Man and the Wasp Saturday at 8? You're going to have to pay a couple extra bucks if you want to go. You know, so that's what's going to happen. They're just basically saying, we can't afford this. We need to raise more money. So if you want to see a big movie on Saturday night, chances are you might have to either hurry to get it early, or you may have to pay a premium. Or we have a premium platform where you can just not worry about that and pay only, you know, $15 a month rather than $10. So we'll see where it ends up.
Yeah, and this is really where their whole business model might hurt them, or the way they're operating could hurt them. I just find that if you're going to have a subscription model like this, you kind of have to keep the rules the same for a while.
They haven't done that once.
Right. Changing every other week, that's a big pain in the neck. Imagine if you subscribe to a gym. Okay, since everybody always goes back to the gym membership with MoviePass, let's take that. And they said, okay, well, today you can't use the treadmill machine because, you know, you only pay $23 a month. And then next week it was, well, you can use the treadmill machine now. Oh, but you can't use the dumbbells. Sorry. It's like, you know, you can't keep up with it if you're a customer.
Well, there's nothing wrong with the idea. You know, they're saying, look, if you're going Friday or Saturday night, you're going to have to pay a little bit more, or you're going to have to get a better service plan, you know, a $15 a month rather than $10 a month. That's not the craziest thing. I can see that,
not
you
at
know,
all.
Makes sense. It's just, you know, the willy-nilly way in which they come up with these ideas and put them into action is driving people nuts. But it's still cheaper than the options. It's still cheaper than AMC's $20 a month where you can't go to any other movie theater.
Right. Now, let's say MoviePass said, look, you know, y'all thought we were too good to be true. It turns out you're right. And in August, they said, we're going to have to, when everybody's subscription kind of turns over, we're going to have to ask for $16.99 per month. Would you still be a MoviePass member?
Absolutely.
See, so there you go. So they could literally almost double the price, almost, well, you know, 1.5 times, and get away with it.
Right, but the best thing they have going for them is the fact that they're piling on consumers, and they said, we're not done yet. They're going to try these new things. Some of them they'll back up off on. In fact, these ridiculous, take a picture of your movie ticket. You know, which does nothing. It doesn't prevent fraud. It doesn't prevent you, if you wanted to sell your ticket after you get your ticket. And then they say, now take a picture of it and send it to us. I'm like, okay. I don't know what that proves.
What they were trying to prove there is that you weren't buying concessions with it. That's really what they were trying
to
prove.
You can't.
Well, you can, and I almost accidentally did, by the way. It was because, remember, the movie passes turned on. They basically turn on the credit card for a certain amount of money in that venue. And so you can use it at the concession stand. And there are some movie theaters where you buy your ticket at the concession stand.
I find that the box office is almost never staffed anymore. The places I go, they want you to get in that line because then you might just buy a concession. So in middle America, I'm finding that's to be just how it's done.
Yes, correct. And
they're like, why have people stand out there alone at the box office, you know, waiting for someone to show up? Why not just have them at the concession stands, force you to go there? In fact, in Birmingham, most places don't have machines to spit your tickets out. You have to go to the concession stand, even if you bought your ticket in advance.
Oh, that's interesting. Come and smell our popcorn.
Yeah, they do not have a machine at the AMC Summit, which has got to be the premium place in Birmingham to go to a movie. There's no machine to just swipe your card and get your ticket. You have to go to the concession stand. It clearly is to drive up concessions. So they have the box office, which is empty, and then you have no machine, and you have to go to the concession stand to get your movie. The problem is, if you have to take a picture of your receipt, some people do buy tickets in advance or get the QR code rather than a physical ticket. So our friend, our in-house film critic, Aaron Rich, is like, I can't take a picture of the ticket because it's a QR code. What am I supposed to do now? And he's like waiting for MoviePass to say, you're not following the rules.
You know what? First of all, he could have taken a screenshot on his phone. Maybe.
He's trying to, but then you can't take a picture of it. You can't take a picture of a screenshot. Because it accesses your camera. It does not access your camera roll.
Got it. Okay. So, yeah, you're right. That's kind of a pain in the neck.
He can't do it. He just keeps sending them a note saying, it's a QR code. What am I supposed to do? And, of course, they don't respond, and there's no one answering the phone.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've been waiting for them to the kind of say, hey, send us a picture of your ticket right when I purchase it, but it's never happened, and I always fear that I've missed the message.
No, you won't miss it. It just pops up and says, you got to do it, and then it says, so don't worry, you'll see it when it gets there. I've gotten it every time. But they're just the gift that keeps on giving, and they don't want to go away. The MoviePass parent company has filed a shelf registration that allows investors to acquire equity and debt in their company. They plan or hope or would really like to raise $1.2 billion so they can make this sucker work. So they can lose money until they make money.
Well, you know, if you actually had, you know, 10 million paying customers, you actually might have something. And I'm not just talking about the data. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, you're a market mover at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish I had 10 million customers going to BookFilter every week.
Oh, well, if you did, then you'd have 10 million people who would know what books they should be reading, because that's kind of what you do at BookFilter. Every week, you look at all the books, the hundreds of thousands of books, by the way, that come out, and you tell all of your visitors, hey, here are the books that you should be paying attention to. Every week here on Showbiz Sandbox, you bring us a book that is kind of ready for its close-up, ready for either an adaptation, well, really, kind of a movie or series adaptation. What have you got for us this week?
Well, this week I've got a fantasy novel by Naomi Novik. She is the author of the Temeraire series. This was sort of a Napoleonic era battles, but with dragons, talking dragons, who were like, hey, we'd like rights too. It was a very clever combination of Napoleonic era naval battles and dragons. Great fun series. She got a ton of attention for it. It began as paperback originals and then blossomed into hardcover as the series went along. There were 9 books in all. Great reviews, a lot of attention. Peter Jackson optioned the series to turn it into a film or a TV series or something. I believe he's remained daunted by the fact that it would be so expensive. It's so expensive to shoot on water, and then you got your dragons and all the food they eat. So the combination of everything kind of overwhelmed. I think he might have even let the option lapse. I'm not sure, but that was how much attention and excitement there was about this series. Very, very clever, really good series, a lot of fun if you love fantasy. Right before that series ended, she came out with a standalone novel called Uprooted. This was sort of a retelling of the Rapunzel tale, and it was terrific. It was just a great book, rooted in Russian folklore, just a marvelous book. Rich, great characters, and really a feminine perspective, by which I mean the idea of like good versus evil, throw it out the window. She just had this embracing humanity with all the characters, even the ones you thought were evil, that showed them to be complex and interesting. Tremendous reviews for this book, a huge commercial success, and now she's done it again. Her new book is called Spinning into Silver, and it's sort of a retelling of Rumpelstiltskin. And it has a great female lead, but it's got 3 great female characters. Our heroine is this determined and smart Jewish daughter of a moneylender. So they're sort of despised by the people around them. But her dad is a really wimpy moneylender. He lends you the money, but then he's too ashamed to ask you to pay him back. And so their family is starving to death. And finally, this little girl at 12 is like, enough. And she goes and she demands the money from all the people who owe them money. And turns out she's really good at it. And then she boasts at one point. She says, you know, I can spin silver into gold. At which point, in pops our fantasy evil creature, the ice creature Starik, which says, here's my silver, turn it into gold. And suddenly she's got a big problem. It's a great book. She's a great character. Her servant Wanda is a great character. This not so pretty daughter of a minor nobleman who's going to be married off to any man who shows up. She's a great character. It's a fascinating book. Lots of great female roles. A terrific author. I'm sure she's on people's radar because her books are selling really well and she's getting great reviews. It is a challenge because it's not a simple story of good versus evil. And a big character is an ice creature, so that's a problem. But that's what special effects are for. So these are dying to be made into movies. Great roles for a lot of women. Someone needs to make this happen.
Well, you know, this movie Uprooted that you said was such a problem to turn into a film, specifically because of the dragons.
No, that's the Temeraire series.
Oh, the Temeraire. Oh, okay. Well, you know, I happen to know the agent for the dragon in Game of Thrones, and he's out of work. So,
oh, well, there you go. They're all looking for something to do. Look at this. I just looked it up. I should not have said Rapunzel because that's not quite right. It is rooted in Baba Yar and the old, who is actually mentioned in Ant-Man and the Wasp, by the way, multiple times as sort of a running gag. But it is rooted in Russian folktales. The finale is a challenge in that movie, but Ellen DeGeneres is involved with the film. She wants to produce the movie adaptation, and Warner Brothers has purchased the rights. So I'm imagining somebody has already purchased Spinning into Silver, and if they haven't, they're crazy.
Well, I know where you can buy Spinning into Silver. You can, of course, buy it right off of BookFilter by going to BookFilter.
Well, we're not a link. You know, we take you to your favorite bookseller, whether it's Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Kobo or Powell's or all that sort of thing. So we're not selling books. We just help you find the books you want.
Well, that's where I was headed with my statement. But I would be surprised that you would send me to Barnes & Noble. I mean, I'm surprised they're still around, even though I do like Barnes & Noble.
Right, but spanning the sections of BookFilter and sexual misconduct, we have the story of Barnes & Noble. Very mysteriously, last week, they fired their CEO, Demos Parneros. He was fired for some violation of company policy. They won't say what it is, but they did say it's got nothing to do with the plans for Barnes & Noble, financial performance, or fraud. Nothing like that, they say. But he has been kicked out the door. He's fired immediately. No severance. And they don't want to talk about it. I mean, Nixon has been more forthcoming about his plans to end the war in Vietnam than Barnes & Noble has been about why they fired their CEO. Total silence. Nobody has said a word. It's been days now, and I'm like waiting for the other shoe to drop. You can't help but think sexual misconduct because that's the world we live in. But who knows? It could be anything. It's just a bizarre mystery.
Yeah, and when I saw that too, of course, my mind immediately leapt to sexual. I thought, well, you're not saying anything, therefore, what do you think in this day and age we're all going to believe?
Yeah, it reminds me of Nickelodeon. They broke ties with their top producer, Dan Schneider, the guy who was in charge of their current number one show and has produced a bevy of hits for Nickelodeon.
Yeah, we talked about this on the last show.
Yeah, he's the most important guy on that at Nickelodeon. And now they've dumped their CEO, and we still have no explanation of why for either of them. So, you know, credit to Barnes & Noble and Nickelodeon. It's hard to keep a secret, but they're doing it.
Yeah, well, you know who didn't keep a secret? Or maybe they did keep a secret, but not for long. Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey.
Well, far too long than they should have. So basically, investigations move forward. Harvey Weinstein has been charged with more sex crimes in New York City. He has been charged with more sex crimes. That's a very major step. Kevin Spacey, on the other hand, London police have confirmed that they are investigating three more sexual assault allegations. So the legal troubles are going to go on for a long time for both of those men. It's certainly a big deal because they were keeping it a secret for far too long than they should have been able to, and now it's all come crashing down.
Well, within that sentence you just kind of spoke were two words, big and deal. So it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
I had no idea I did that. It must have slipped out. Big deal? I said big deal?
You all did, right, say big deal. Now, our first story. Hey, Michael, here's a question. Are you covering the Fantasia Film Festival in Montreal starting on July 12th?
Why, yes. Yes, I am.
That's great because, you know, I've got my flight scheduled and my hotel booked. I'm actually right now, while, you know, you're talking and telling our listeners about who knows what, I'm looking on Yelp for some ideas on where we can eat because, you know.
No. I'm not going to Montreal. I'm just turning on my laptop.
Wait, what? Oh, I see. Well, it turns out you can cover Fantasia without actually attending Fantasia. In what may be a first, this is the festival, accrediting journalists and sharing links for the movies playing at the festival. You can stay home and enjoy the world premieres as long as your internet connection is good. I'm building my red carpet right now. I'm putting in my red carpeted steps. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I think can see other film festivals doing this as well. It's part of the new world we live in. With Magna Review closing down in New York City, there are far fewer places where journalists can go to see movies. They're just being sent links or they're being sent DVD screeners. And that's happening more and more. And now it's coming to film festivals. But the advantage of having people in a room and talking about them and sharing buzz and saying, oh, you've got to see that film, you're losing out on something. They talked about that at Magno. You're going to lose something about that at film festivals. But frankly, I can imagine a day where that happens at Cannes. It's crazy. It'll be the last one to happen. But you know what? It's just the way of the world. It's cheaper. It's easier. They'll get more attention.
Yeah, you know, I'll find films that are, and they're generally independent films. They're being released on just a few screens. They'll only have one or two screenings for the press ahead of time, and I'll say, look, you know, I can't make that screening. Are there any screeners I can watch? Now, I really make sure that every screener that I watch, I never watch on a laptop or on an iPad. For me, it always has to be either. Well, it's on a big, giant screen, and I, you know,
But there are links that they send you that you can't transfer to your TV.
That's where I was headed. Oh. And I always have to say, look, I'm going to have to see the screening because obviously, there's no way for me to look at this on, you know, Vimeo, for instance. Sometimes
Lawrence
you can't.
Of Arabia isn't going to cut it on your iPhone.
Right. Exactly. And I'll watch anything. You know, I will literally watch anybody's movie. Now, I might not talk about it, which mean, you know, I'm not going to say anything negative about your film if I don't like it, but I will watch it, and I will watch it all the way to the end. And I know a lot of people don't do that, but I always try to make sure that it is seen in, you know, stereo, surround sound if possible. And thank you, Apple, for having the screen sharing capabilities, screencasting capabilities. That helps sometimes. But like Festival Scope, for instance, doesn't have an app for a smart TV that you can use. So you have to, you know, do it through Apple TV. It's kind of a whole big pain in the neck.
I know people have done it for shorts, but are you aware of any film festival of any note that has actually made feature films available on a broad basis to critics?
Not on a broad basis, no.
Yeah.
Not
individual
like
films by individual distributors, but this is the festival doing it.
Correct.
That's what seems new to me, and the fact that we're talking feature films, not shorts.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm on planes all the time, and there are movies that I won't watch on, you know, 12-hour international flights because I'm like, I'm not going to watch XYZ movie. You know, I want to see that in a comfortable setting on a nice big screen. Even if it's not projected, I want it to be a big 65, 70-inch, you know, television screen with surround sound, and, you know, I want to see it in the best possible way to do justice for the filmmakers. And I'm not going to see it on a seat back on a 12-inch screen.
You know, you have such integrity. You should be a member of the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences.
Well, it's funny. I'd probably be more of a film industry insider than some of the people they have invited, because the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is determined to increase its numbers and its diversity. They have invited a record 928 people to join, and the numbers do tell the story. About half of the people invited are women, and 38% are people of color. If everyone accepted, 31% of the Academy would then be women and 16% people of color, which is probably why my invitation got lost in the mail. That's despite the fact, by the way, that in the last 3 years, they have jumped from inviting 322 people to 683 and now 928, all while some complain they are blurring the lines of TV and film too much. Among the bold-faced names who could start voting on the Best Picture winner, Dave Chappelle, Mindy Kaling, if only for rescuing Ocean's 8, Amy Schumer, Kumail Nanjiani, Sarah Silverman, Tiffany Haddish, Miles Teller, hey, wait a second, he's a white guy, Timothy Chalamet, wait a second, he's a white guy too, Damon Wayans, and many more. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I'm going to say it's a big whoop. They're doing the right thing. They're dramatically increasing the number of people they invite, but they have such a long history of things to redress. I mean, you just look at the numbers. It's going to be a long haul before they get to beginning to match what they want to do, much less increase the numbers of people actually participating in the business, so there's a bigger pool of people to draw upon. So it's moving in the right direction, and they are speeding it up, which is good. You know, they've almost, you know, tripled the number of people they're inviting in the last 3 years. So it's, you know, and it's cool stuff, and there's good, you know, no Sperling. The reason you didn't get an invite is because you don't make movies. But like, white people are still getting in. The Florida Project's Sean Baker, very excited to see him on the list. Luca Guadagnino for Call Me By Your Name. Jean-Pierre Junot from Amelie. My God, the man should have been in there years ago.
Yeah,
so,
good grief.
It's good. It's good to see. The total membership is now 9,226 if all these new people accept an invite. So the Academy is getting big. They're about to hit 10,000 members.
Now, you know, what do you think of people? The big eyebrow raiser everybody pointed to was, who do you think it was? The one that everybody went, what?
I don't know. I mean, there's 900 invites, so, you know.
Audra McDonald.
Audra McDonald?
Yes.
Well, she's in a film, isn't she?
She's in one film, Beauty and the Beast.
Well, that was a big smash hit, and she's a major talent. She's been a big hit on TV and Broadway, and there's no reason she won't make more films. You know what? I mean, she'd be happy to make more films. I'm sure she doesn't object to making films. She'd like to make films.
Yeah, no, you know? Hey, you know what? I'm sure.
No, she's been in 10 films. Seven Servants, The Object of My Affection, Cradle Will Rock, It Runs in the Family, The Best Thief in the World, Rampart, Ricky and the Flash. She had a role in that. She had a role in Beauty and the Beast, and she appeared in Hello Again, which is a glorified adaptation of a Broadway musical. But, you know, she's been in a couple movies now. She's a big, big star. So what?
You know who else is in the Academy?
No.
Eric Estrada.
Well, there you go.
The magazine Time Out New York has made it official. It's bi. Yes, what? It is. It's bi. Bi-weekly, that is. The free paper has been sort of weekly and sort of bi-weekly for a while. Now it's ending that annoying habit and making up its mind. It's bi-weekly for good. Most, if not all, of the Time Out magazines in major cities around the world switched to handing out free copies in the last few years. That boosted circulation, but hasn't ended the slowdown in editorial and cutbacks among staff. Now Time Out New York thinks a consistent every 2-week print schedule will help clarify things and make readers, at least it'll keep readers around, so you can pay for, you know, home delivery, pick up a free copy, and depend on it appearing every other week. In other words, it offers something for everyone. Maybe it's polyamorous, too. What do you think? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. You know, they're still around. God bless them. It's hard to compete with online. People are using their phones to check everything. I love Time Out. I loved it at the time. I still think it's a cool resource in some major cities. It's hard to find your niche, though, isn't it? Boy, oh boy.
Well, you know, speaking of magazines that kind of have changed their print schedule, so I get this kind of postcard in the mail, and, you know, I'm ready to throw it out, to be honest. It looked like junk mail. But it turns out that my subscription to Rolling Stone is going to expire in September, right? And it says, look, you're in the smallest print possible, by the way. I have never seen print this small.
You and your eyes. This seems to be a running theme. Is there an optometrist in the house?
Yeah, I'm good. Actually, I have an optometrist appointment July 18th. Thank you very much. but it says here that that my subscription is going to run out. And it will automatically renew for 1 year, and I will be charged $35, which, guess what, is 70% off the cover price. Now, I immediately thought to myself, wait a second, I never paid $35 for Rolling Stone magazine, ever. I paid like $19, okay, or $20. I think when I first got it, I paid $12 at the introductory offer. $35? Why the heck would I pay for that? And then it goes on to say, in even smaller print, an annual term of Rolling Stone is currently 12 issues, which is subject to change at any time. Well, wait a second. Right now, an annual subscription to Rolling Stone is like 26 issues. So why would it all of a sudden be 12? So I went, and of course, they're going to a monthly distribution.
When does that take place?
Well, apparently it already has, because I just got my first monthly July issue, and it looks like Variety. It looks and feels like Rolling Stone, but in Variety form. It's got, you know, the perfect bound spine, and it's not staple stitched or saddle stitched. It's a whole new world.
It's changing times. They can't print every 2 weeks.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess every 2 weeks the magazine was paper thin. No pun intended. Now, Star Trek has always boldly gone where no one has gone before. Not this time, though. Instead, the sci-fi franchise is making like Marvel and expanding its universe with a host of new shows in the planning stages. First, CBS signed a big new deal with Star Trek, Discovery's showrunner Alex Kurtzman. Then rumors began leaking about new programming, including a return for Captain Jean-Luc Picard that was teased online by, well, actor Patrick Stewart himself. In the works maybe are the following: a teen-oriented series set at, yes, you guessed it, Starfleet Academy, a miniseries built...
Yes,
I know, it's kind of a no-brainer, really. a miniseries built around the villain Khan, an animated series, another miniseries with a super-secret plot and something or other with Patrick Stewart, unless he's going to be teaching at Starfleet Academy. The possibilities really are endless, and reproducing faster than Tribbles. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal in a bad sense. You know, they have been so careful and good with Star Trek, and they've kept this franchise alive for 50 years. They've had TV shows and films and books and video games, and to suddenly grossly expand the number of TV shows and things that you make from this. It's always been an event when they made a new Star Trek series, and to suddenly have five of them or seven of them just doesn't feel wise to me. But content, content, content. Everyone wants content, I guess, and that's what's driving this. Everybody needs content. Apple made a deal with Sesame Street Workshop. They've got a whole bunch of new projects to do. Of course, HBO already has Sesame Street, but right. They're going to be doing live action, puppet-based TV shows, animation. Everybody needs content.
Our next story is about video games, which are taking a cue from the newfound popularity of Spotify, Netflix, and the subscription model. Rather than shelling out $80 for a video game and never seeing the customer again, video game publishers have made a profound shift to a new model where many games are far less expensive, or they're even free to play, but fans cough up money for new levels of play, weapons and goods and the like. Monster franchise hit Fortnite takes that even further. Everything is free except for non-essential stuff like dance moves and clothing to show off to your friends. It's working. Fortnite grossed, get this, $318 million in May. And since its launch, the game has pulled in $1.2 billion. And it's still steamrolling along. So is Pokemon Go, which saw a new burst of interest after that free game launched some new features as well. Hey, can cable TV become free too? That would really be nice. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, I think. This is, you know, between having access to just online video games rather than buying a cartridge, and the fact that a lot of games are going to be free or have extra platforms that you pay money for, little micro payments as you go along, rather than one big payment up front. It's really transforming the industry. Fortnite, we're using as a broad-based name to indicate both Fortnite and Fortnite Battle Royale. There's a couple different levels here. They've been rolling them out over the last few months, starting in July of 2017. So there's a lot of different things going on with Fortnite, and it's all working. I mean, over $1.2 billion in-app purchases, and they don't even need the stuff. That's what's crazy about it. You can play Fortnite all you want and not have to pay for clothes or dance moves or that stuff, but people are having a blast and they're happy to do it. So it's just crazy. But it's a whole new way of thinking about video games. They're there. You can play them. Oh, you want some cool extra stuff? Give us $3, $2, $1, $5. And that's the way they're going to be.
You know, what's interesting is I noticed some of my recent trips, people were all of a sudden playing Pokemon Go again. And I mean older people. I don't mean like, you know, teenagers. I'm talking like 35-year-olds.
Like me.
Why are people playing that game all of a sudden?
Because, like we said, they added in some new features and spruced it up and got a new burst of attention.
So what did they add?
I haven't been playing it.
Okay. Neither have I, as I...
I did play it fairly consistently when it came out, just for a few weeks, just because it was fun and just to see how it was working and what people were looking at. So it was cool. And then every once in a while, I would stumble across a kid or a friend's kid who was playing it, and then we would go play it. So that was a fun way of bonding with the kids, looking cool. But, you know, just really want to check out the augmented reality and what was going on there. So that was cool. So, you know, it was very popular. Its download numbers have increased to over 800 million people, 800 million downloads of the Pokemon Go app. That's what's been happening worldwide. That's a lot of downloads. So whatever they've done lately, I haven't stayed on top of it, but I'm sure it's cool.
You ready to hear me sound like I'm a Silicon Valley insider?
Please.
I wonder what their AMUs are.
What are AMUs?
Average monthly users.
Oh, right, of course, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'd love to have better figures on video game revenue. It's one of those industries where there's sort of a black hole, I feel like. There's no good chart. There's no good reporting. Every once in a while with something like Fortnite, you suddenly hear, oh, they made $1.2 billion over the last 6 months. You're like, really? I should have been reading more stories about you.
They don't have to pay any royalties. That's why.
That's right. Well, they do, surely.
No, who's the actor in that? Who's the...
There are voice actors in video games all the time.
Yeah, but not for Fortnite. Well,
I don't know Fortnite, but I'm just saying in general, there's no good reporting of revenue in the industry.
Well, true.
All right.
Although, please do feel free to correct us.
Well, we should have had this. Yes, please do. Send us a link. We should have had this next story right after the Academy trying to diversify its members.
That's true, because the movies can finally boast of female directors delivering blockbuster films. Unfortunately for Hollywood, the good news comes from China. While the summer season is just heating up, the Chinese New Year is the equivalent of their December holiday rush. So it's big news that three of the biggest hits of the year so far were helmed by women. Us and Them has $200 million and counting. How Long Will I Love You scored $135 million. And the much-delayed Forever Young, which hit roughly $115 million. It turns out the movie was delayed so it wouldn't inadvertently, by the way, inspire protests around the party Congress. It wasn't the content so much as the timing. So women are proving they've got the chops to deliver commercial hits. Now, how soon before a woman lands an action flick or even the next Monkey King franchise? Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal. More women making more movies means better product for everyone. It means better diverse film stories that you're telling. It means you're going to have more chance of connecting with audiences. So it's good for everybody.
If Hollywood is wary of doing business with anyone owning Fox News, which we discussed on last week's show, will they now stop cooperating with the celebrity puffery of the gossip magazines controlled by Trump fan American Media Inc.?
That's right. We're basically saying, hey, people were upset about Fox News and the propaganda coming from there. Well, they need to look at the people who are helping their actual business, which is publicizing movies and movie stars, and that's American Media Inc. They're going to have some hard questions to ask themselves. Why?
Well, as of mid-June, AMI has taken control of a slew of celebrity magazines owned by a German company. Those include In Touch, Life and Style, and Closer. The publishing group has gone to great lengths to write favorable coverage of Trump and his family, kill stories that could harm them and more, making it the tabloid equivalent of Fox News. How big is AMI's reach? Well, they own the National Enquirer, Us Weekly, OK, In Touch, Life and Style, Closer, and Star. They have a combined weekly circulation of more than 5 million people and a weekly audience of 51 million.
51 million people. That's a lot of people.
Which means that their magazines have a turnover of 10. That's pretty remarkable.
Well, I think it's also people seeing, maybe the audience includes people who are just seeing them in the checkout line.
Yes, because that's basically the only time I ever see those magazines.
Right.
Now, many of their stories, let's face it, they're puff pieces made in cooperation with Hollywood celebs and their publicists. That is, when they're not allegedly covering up the misdeeds of Harvey Weinstein, buying off accusers, and trying to smear Trump's critics. So will Hollywood stop playing nicely with Us Weekly and the rest? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, you know, it's a big deal, I think. Basically, they control every big celebrity weekly that's not named People Magazine. Other than People Magazine,
well,
they control
Entertainment
them
Weekly.
All.
Entertainment Weekly.
Well, that's not a celebrity weekly.
Well, true.
It's not. You know, I don't think we're being too narrow here, but these are a lot of celebrity weeklies that puff up celebs, and they control them all except the Big Daddy People Magazine. In December, the New York Times ran a bombshell story about the links AMI went to help protect Harvey Weinstein. That was a wake up call. Now they've bought up a lot more magazines, and they're a lot more powerful. Will Hollywood start to boycott them? I don't think so, but we'll see.
Yeah, I don't think that they will either. I think that as it is, people don't really tend to cooperate with Us Weekly. At least the celebrities don't. The publicists sometimes do. They try to just fly under the radar.
Whatever. I think just George Clooney tried to do a boycott of E.T. I don't think that ever really took.
No, it didn't.
When E.T. was cooperating with paparazzi, I think the fact that AMI is in the bag for Trump and the biggest scandal that's hit Hollywood in years, I don't think they're going to care.
Instagram isn't messing around. For years, it has included video to go along with the billions of photos of the dinners all your friends are about to eat. Those videos were 15 seconds long, and then they were 60 seconds, and then up to 10 minutes in length. Now Instagram, and by Instagram we mean, let's face it, Facebook.
And by Facebook we mean Mark Zuckerberg.
Right. Well, they're launching a new service dubbed IGTV. They did this a couple weeks ago. It's an app for creators who want to launch long-form videos and have their own channel, a la YouTube. Wait a second. And by YouTube, by the way, we mean Alphabet. and by Alphabet, we mean Google. It's a way to give even more visibility to Insta stars and their content, kind of stars like, you know, you and I, Michael. Big deal or big whoop?
My eyes glaze over when talk turns to social media. What do you think, Sperling?
Well, I think, you know, time will tell. You know, every new platform needs its stars and something that will draw people to it and somebody who will use it in a creative and inventive way. I'm sure this platform will find it. Instagram already has a huge audience. So it's got a leg up on things like what is no longer around, like Meerkat, you know, any type of new service that would try and start. So it could actually work.
All right.
You know, I didn't think Vivo would work. And granted,
it didn't.
It didn't ultimately, but for a while it did. And, you know, I didn't think Hulu would work. It did. So
once they changed it entirely from what it was to something else.
Right. And Vivo worked up until they decided to give all of their content to YouTube. And then, of course, it didn't work. People just went to YouTube. And so will this work? Maybe. People are already on Facebook. Will they stick around for an hour to watch a show? I don't know. We'll find out. We'll also find out what happens to Sony Pictures, which is embracing vertical integration, not by buying an internet service provider. No, they're doing it by looking at TV from soup to nuts and putting all those various divisions under one roof. So the Sony Television Studios and the Sony Cable Channels, like the Game Show Network and Sony Movie Channel and whatever streaming service they're cooking up, like Crackle and their DVD and digital home entertainment divisions. And instead of saying, look, play nice, they're saying, it's all the same thing. What's the difference? Get to work and make us more money. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I think maybe they're going to lose something by combining everything into one big soup. You know, things need attention. And sometimes when you mash them all together, suddenly, you know, stuff like DVD gets considered an afterthought. You know, that's why I had a separate division from the movie studios. I mean, movies are the same, right? Whether a film or on cable. But, you know, you need different love and care and attention for different parts of the chain. I don't know if they're helping themselves here. What do you think?
You know, I think in some regard, certainly putting the cable channels together with Sony Pictures Television, that makes sense. Okay, fine. Get all of those together. Maybe even put the streaming service together, because effectively it's just another network, really, when you think about it. It's just another distribution platform. Putting home entertainment, DVD and digital downloads, and yeah, I agree with you there. I think maybe you could have kept that separate.
But on the other hand, you know, Crackle, great idea. They just lost Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. That jumped from Crackle to Netflix.
Can't imagine why. Netflix
more money?
And Netflix just doesn't have any comedians doing anything.
They offered them more money, I guess.
Yeah, maybe. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week's stories will have you tapping your toes and stamping your feet.
Because it has to do with music?
I had no transition there. So that
was. You just did it great. Talking about the Grammy Awards.
Well, the Grammys just got bigger, actually. They're reflecting the fact that there are more movies, more TV shows, more books, and more albums being released than ever before in history. The Grammys is following the lead of most major awards and expanding its top categories. Instead of announcing the best five albums of the year nominees, they'll be announcing, get this, eight. The same goes for record and song and new artist. All other categories will remain the same, however. Big deal or big whoop. Never mind.
Well, no,
it's
not
a
big deal or big whoop.
No,
we're in Inside Baseball. It's an entirely different category. It's completely different from what we were doing before. To me, I'm excited. But dear God, why not do 10? What is wrong with all you people? Let's have 7 best films. Let's have 9 best films, but not 10. That would be outrageous. We can't have 10 films. Even though 1,000 movies come out a year in New York City, people are like, well, we couldn't come up with 10. Even though every critic says, here are the 10 best films of the year. Same thing with albums. People all the time, the 10 best albums of the year. People want to know your top 10 favorite albums of the year, your top 10 favorite movies of all time. Why do people hate the number 10? I don't get it.
Maybe it's just too round. Too many numerals. I don't know.
I think as you set it up, it's like, look, there are so much music. It just makes sense to expand it to 10 or to 8. It doesn't mean we're going to solve all the problems and it's going to be so diverse. It doesn't mean that the big, obvious, dumb one is still going to win. Maybe it means the boring album will still win. Maybe it'll even make it more likely because there's more options to chip away at the other favorites. You know, oh, I was going to vote for number 2, but now I'll vote for number 7. You know, so, you know, we'll have to see how it plays out. But I think it's great. There's a ton of music out there. There's no reason not to expand the categories. You don't want 100. You don't want so many categories that it's meaningless, but I don't think there's any reason you can't say yes. The 10 new best albums of the year, yes. 10 best songs of the year, yes. 10 best records, yes. Best new artist,
yeah. That's where did that come from?
That's the one they should not have expanded.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Eight is a lot. 8 people you want to say, wow, great new artist. 5 is often hard to come up with. So, you know, that maybe I would have expanded every best album category. 10 best country albums of the year, 10 best Latin albums of the year, 10 best gospel albums of the year. Bring it on. But 10 best jazz albums, but 10 best new artists, that's a little pushing it. But what do I know? You got tens of thousands of albums coming out. I'm sure they'll find the people. There was a little back and forth, though, about the TV show, because that's what really matters here, the performance on the TV show. And the networks are saying, hey, just like you guys just copied the other award show and said you want more nominees and the best album, we want to copy the other award shows and have less awards on the actual air. Can we not list the best engineering sound recording of 2017?
Well, what I would say is they only give out like 2 awards as it is now anyway.
They still want more flexibility. They still want to be able to keep some awards off the air so they can have more room for the performances that are what people care about.
Well, I think they gave out, what, like 8 awards last year, maybe?
I don't think they gave out more than 8, but yeah.
I mean, maybe they even gave out less than that. So, because they certainly didn't give out 10, since nobody likes that.
Everybody hates the number 10.
Exactly.
Poor 10. I mean, the Olympics got rid of the perfect 10. Everybody knew a perfect 10 in gymnastics. Gone. What is wrong with you people? All I know is Drake is the king of the world. While Sperling was away, Drake released a new album, and it set so many streaming records. And all I could think of was, oh my God, please, Sperling, don't talk about 132 million streams for the new album, but that was 50 million more than Post Malone's, but that's 37% less than what they did on the next day. You know, it's like, let's face it. Drake set all sorts of records in streaming. He had 132 million streams on Spotify, 170 million streams on Apple. That was just during one day. 300 million streams on those two services alone in one day. It was the number one album on the Apple charts in 92 countries. And since then, he has broken all sorts of records. He set the all-week record in like 3 days. And now I'm sure he has set the total 7-day record, which is going to be even exponentially bigger. The point is, there's so many people streaming now. These records are going to keep falling week by week. You know, Post Malone just set that record a few weeks ago. There's going to be another record breaking Drake's record 3, 5, 6 months from now. So it's cool. It's great. It's significant. But the numbers are being so outpaced so quickly that we're not even near the top yet. So just say, okay, yeah, he had a big week.
Okay, yeah, he had a big week. This Drake
exactly.
Character, this Drake cat, as some of the cool kids say.
So did Spotify.
Yeah, let me ask you something. Has this happened to you, Michael? You go onto Spotify and it says, hey, Sperling, or for you, it would say, hey, Michael, Janelle Monáe is coming to your area. And just because you're a big fan, she's offering you a chance to buy tickets. Fan first.
That's absolutely happened to me. I've been noticing it and I haven't put 2 and 2 together, but yep, they can see I'm following an artist on Spotify. And then when there's a concert in my area, they say, hey, this artist is coming to your area. You want a ticket? Click right here.
Well, I've been a Spotify subscriber since 2008 and, you know, heaven forbid they should actually let, you know, do that for me. They don't. They tell me, oh, you know, here's the next concert for a particular artist that whether I'm following them or not.
They're doing. What do you mean?
Well, very often those concerts are in like England or Norway or, you know, some other country.
They don't know your area?
No, they do. They do. They
always tell me wherever I am, like physically that time. When I'm in New York, they tell me concerts happening in New York. And when I'm in Alabama, they tell me about shows happening here.
Maybe
so
I have
they
to.
Adjust it. They adjust it based on where I'm actually at. So you need to just change your setting.
Yeah, maybe I have to change my setting, and then they'll make me a fan first.
That's right.
You know, last year Spotify generated more than $40 million in concert ticket sales via I think they had over 1,000 promo campaigns with some 700 artists. And they want that.
That doesn't sound like a lot of money.
It doesn't sound like a lot of money, but especially when they're talking hundreds of millions of dollars that have to go to record companies. But they want that number to get much, much bigger. So they're expanding the Fan First program even as you and I speak right now at this very hour.
Sunday night? Late
Sunday
at night?
Yes. They're doing it right now. Daniel Ek is up doing it. They're also taking the Viva Latino brand to the concert stage with events held under that banner. That sprang from a very popular Viva Latino playlist with more than 8 million followers, not to mention the success Spotify had sponsoring concerts focused on hip-hop like Rap Caviar, which also sprung from a playlist, by the way. You know what we need, Michael, is a playlist. Forget about a music blog. We need a playlist. That's what we need. Up next, by the way, a hot country concert branded by a playlist of the same name and starring Carrie Underwood. So expect more of that sort of thinking, and soon. We need a podcast playlist, and fast.
Well, I think it's very, very smart. You know, like they're saying, how can we monetize all these people coming to Spotify? And it's a smart thing. We've got a super popular playlist. Let's turn it into a concert tour. We've got a really popular artist and fans. We know what fans like them and we know where those fans are. We'll link to their concert tickets when they go on sale. It's a convenient. It's easy. I didn't have to ask for it. I assume I can opt out if I want to. But you know what? I like it. In fact, I've started following more artists just to make sure if and when they come to my area, I'll get a little notice.
Well, you know, I think Spotify hired Dawn Osteroff as the chief content officer. So they are taking the Netflix route where they were known for having other people's content and they will continue to be known for having other people's content. But at the same time, they're going to have some of their own.
But they're not going to start making music.
No, I don't think so. No.
They have made deals with acts, though. They are trying to... So they're going to try to do everything. So, but unlike Netflix, they haven't been raking in big bucks that they can use to purchase content or create new content. They're actually losing money, aren't they?
Yes, and as far as signing acts, what they're doing is they're going to unsigned acts, and they're saying, look, just you don't need an album or a record company. Just you know, you could come directly to us. We'll list your music. And it will be there, you know, for people to stream. Well, what that will do over time is, you know, all of those indie darlings will actually, some of them will fade away. And some of them will be big hits. And those big hits will say, well, why do I need the record company? I'm already a big hit.
Well, they don't need a lot of hits either. They just need a lot of singles. That's what Amazon has done with self-published authors. They don't care if you don't sell 50,000 copies of a book. You sell 1,000, they get a little cut slice of every penny. So they're doing all right. But I love music. I've been traveling all over the country for the last few weeks. I was down in Florida. I was in Atlanta. I was in Nashville. Now I'm back in Birmingham. But over the July 4th weekend, I thought it was kind of cool. Cardi B had the number one song in the country on July 4th, and it was a bilingual number. I Like It is the song, and it's probably a little bit more English than Spanish, but there's a lot of Spanish in that song, and it's just a sign of the times, but very cool to see.
Oh, really? Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you can check it out. What you can't do is buy her new album at Best Buy.
I thought you couldn't buy Drake's album at Best Buy.
Well, they don't like Drake. They don't like Cardi. They don't like music. They said enough with the compact discs. That's yesterday's news. Everybody's on their phone streaming on Spotify. So we're just going to get rid of the CDs. I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet to DVDs, frankly.
I know.
The footprint is getting smaller and smaller. It's only a matter of time. Any minute now, they're going to stop selling DVDs and Blu-ray as well. And they pretty much have. I mean, the space allotted to them is so small. You go to Target, they've still got CDs, but it's shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and even more so with DVDs and Blu-ray. It's just, it's going to fade away.
Well, yeah.
It's going to fade away and die.
Oh, okay. Kind of like Steve Ditko, the co-creator of Spider-Man and the comic book artist. He died at the age of 90.
That's right. We moved into the obituary section. And Steve Ditko was a big, big figure in comic books. I didn't realize that he continued to create works that were being seen. I thought he was such a recluse that he wasn't actually publishing anything, but he has been all these years. He co-created Spider-Man and Doctor Strange with Stan Lee way back in the 60s. Those were two of his biggest creations. And then he had this infamous falling out with Stan Lee over nobody knows what over. he wouldn't say, and Stanley says, I don't know when it's over. But whatever it was, probably a lack of credit or feeling like Stanley sucked up all the oxygen. He left Marvel in 1966, but even before Jack Kirby, I believe, because he split with Stanley as well. And he wanted to do some other outlets like DC. And then he did some indie stuff for over many, many years, created characters. But in terms of the media and the press and the public, he went completely silent. He's known as the J.D. Salinger of comic books. He just wouldn't talk to anyone. But he was creating characters. He created Squirrel Girl, which I've been seeing for a number of years. He created her like 2 years or two decades before she became popular. So he created these characters that inspired other artists or took a long time or some new people would step in and take over and then make them famous. So he has been really creative and successful over the last 50 years, but he has not been in the public spotlight. And now he's died. So it's very sad to see, but we've got a link to Graham McMillan's appreciation in The Hollywood Reporter. It was really good and really sort of put his career in perspective, because I don't know him very well, but sad to see him dying. Kind of sad to see Stan Lee in the middle of Ant-Man and the Wasp. He had his little cameo, and all I could think of was, oh my God, that poor man is being waylaid by horrible people on the left and the right. He's got such legal travails. It's very sad.
It was also sad to hear that Robbie Mueller died, and he is a Dutch cinematographer and probably best known for, I would say probably Paris, Texas, and Down by Law and Buena Vista Social Club. Breaking the Waves, certainly. Didn't have a tripod for that one, I noticed.
he did a lot of work with Jim Jarmusch and a really well-respected cinematographer, as is science fiction writer Harlan Ellison. He died at 84. This one made a big impression on me because he was a major talent during the silver age of sci-fi, I guess I would call it, the 60s through the 70s and 80s. He was fired on the first day of his job at Disney Studios. He was a writer there, and he stood up in the middle of the commissary and started to describe pornographic ideas about what should happen to all the Disney characters, and people were not amused. But he was a pain in the neck. You know, he wrote more than 1,700 short stories, novels. He wrote scripts for Star Trek and The Outer Limits and Babylon 5 and Route 66 and Man from U.N.C.L.E. He pushed science fiction into new adult areas of speculative fiction. Kind of like Kurt Vonnegut, he wanted to be known as a writer of fiction, not science fiction. He was a lightning rod. He was a pain in the neck. He sued over all sorts of people ripping off his work, everything from the Terminator to the merchandising from Star Trek, and he won a lot of times. But what I remember him best for are two anthologies. One of them was called Dangerous Visions, published in 1967, and then in 1972, again, Dangerous Visions. These were two signal works where he collected boundary-pushing short stories written by all these science fiction writers, some of which couldn't even be published at the time. They were sort of that out there or seen as like, oh my God, where's the razor? You know, where's the ray gun and the monster alien? You know, what is this story dealing with sex and religion? You know, they couldn't handle this stuff. And he published them in these two anthologies that really sent shockwaves through the industry, showed what could be possible with science fiction, and pushed it out further and made it a more mature adult genre that could encompass so many things that we take for granted today. When I was a kid, I read them and they were like, I was kind of not ready for them. I was like, oh, what the hell's going on here? You know, something. there was all sorts of things going on. And I was like making sure my mom wasn't seeing what I was reading and reading more, but it was a little ahead of my time. It was not pornographic by any stretch of the imagination. It just dealt with ideas and concepts and things of like gender identity, things we would talk about today and are sort of new and strange to us. They were dealing with this stuff way back when. Very cool stuff. Really interesting guy. Probably glad I never interviewed him because he sounds like a pain in the neck. But
which you've said a couple times. Certainly sounds egotistical. Kind of.
Oh my gosh, yes. Healthy ego. Let's just say that. Just like Claude Lanzmann.
That was my way of getting to Claude Lanzmann, who was the director of Shoah, who died at the age of 92 just last year. In Cannes, I saw the film Napalm, which was about Lanzmann's trip back to North Korea. He had been there in the 1950s, and he was a documentary filmmaker, and he in Napalm, it was a very kind of navel-gazing look at a romantic exchange that he had without actually words because nobody spoke the same language and, you know, under the repressive regime of North Korea. And the story was fascinating, I have to say, but it was also very egotistical.
Well, you know, he's you know, when you get praised to high heaven as being one of the greatest filmmakers of all time and have a landmark work of such importance as Shoah, which dealt with the Holocaust, it's hard not to get a big ego, I imagine. It's amazing when people are not insufferable sometimes, because everywhere you turn, people tell you how marvelous you are. But he will be remembered forever for Shoah. It's a 9.5-hour documentary film. It is not just an important document. It is also a great work of art. It is really fascinating what he did and how he did it and the rigorousness of it. And it's absolutely compelling. You think, oh my God, 9.5 hours on the Holocaust? I don't want to. Wow. As soon as it starts, you are drawn in, you are fascinated, and you cannot turn away. And then usually there's a break. I saw it over 2 days the first time I saw the movie. There's a break, and then there's a longer break, and you come back the next day to see the second half, and you're like, oh, I don't want to go back in and see another 4.5 hours. But as soon as it begins again, you are completely absorbed. I mean, it's really that amazing of a work. It is art. It's also an important document. It's just an amazing film. And he'll be remembered as long as cinema exists.
Kind of like we'll be remembered. And this show will be remembered. This particular
episode.
This show
is also 9.5 hours long.
Yes, exactly. With no break, in fact. We don't have the break. We're a one-act play.
They might have put us on pause once or twice.
Exactly. We're a two-gym visit podcast. Yeah. But you know what? We promise we'll try to make our future shows shorter. And just so that you can find out whether, you know, you can hold us to our promise, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, or you can aggregate podcasts, your podcatcher. You know what? Subscribe to us and find out if we keep our promise. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us and ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter at showbizsandbox is our handle, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's NaomiNovikRocks.com.
I wish I knew what that was referencing.
Naomi Novik, the writer of Uprooted and Spinning into Silver.
Okay. That was like 4.5 hours ago. You expect me to remember that? You're right, actually. I should have remembered that. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing at that particular website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his coverage of the entertainment industry can be found. And don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.